Hello, and thanks for tuning in to killradio.org. You're listening to a live interview with author Christian Williams, author of American Methods, Torture, and the Logic of Domination. Christian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So, there have been a lot of different books and essays written on torture. I'm curious, what inspired you to write your own, and specifically addressing America's use of torture both at home and abroad?
Well, the largest impetus, I guess, was the Abu Ghraib scandal, and specifically the way it was being talked about and largely misconstrued in the American media. I mean, when the scandal hit, when the photos first came out, pretty much across the board, the response was that, this isn't the way we do things in America. And that was true of people like, that was the kind of thing that people like Donald Rumsfeld were saying, who were trying to sort of downplay the significance of the Abu Ghraib pictures. And it was also true of people, more on the left, who were trying to sort of express their outrage. And what I was very aware of, having written a book a couple years ago about police brutality, was that, in fact, it is how we do things in America. And it seemed like that was very much getting lost. And the larger context, any sort of history of the way Abu Ghraib related to the way the United States had carried on previous wars, or the way that the United States ran its own prison system, within its borders, or of some very clear policy decisions that have been reported just a little bit before, such as the most prominently the decision by George W. Bush that the Geneva Conventions weren't going to apply to the war in Afghanistan. I mean, I had basically been assuming that things like that were happening based on the previous history and based on the Bush administration's the direction of its policy.
You were assuming that there's been torture happening, you mean?
Yes, I just, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if the government makes a claim that the Geneva Conventions are not going to apply, that abuses of the conventions will be the obvious outcome.
Right.
For that matter, there hadn't been photographs, but there had been stories reported in the press since the invasion of Afghanistan and then continuing in Iraq, of prisoners being abused and, in fact, prisoners dying under interrogation. And somehow the same newspapers which had run those earlier stories just forgot everything that they had reported over the past several years.
And collective amnesia being very common in this time anyway.
Yeah, it was just completely consigned to the memory hole. And the insistence on treating the Abu Ghraib scandal as though it were just some sort of anomaly really just got under my skin. And I got worked up enough about it that I decided to write a book.
So essentially what you're saying is that one of the few ways the left and the right seem to agree is on covering up the fact that torture and abuse is very much an American part of American culture and American history. And it's true. You notice that on the left, there's definitely this large attitude of, well, we're supposed to be better than this. So anything that sounds like it could be torture is something we should get very upset about because America never does things like that. And then on the right is, we should be pretending that we're better than that so that we can get away with it when no one's looking.
In some ways, it's very much sort of a mirror image of each other. There are important differences, I think. I mean, when Donald Rumsfeld or George Bush says, well, this isn't the way we do things in America, they're just lying. Like, they know that it is, and they're pretending like it's not. On the other hand, when, sort of well-meaning liberals say, well, this isn't how we do things in America, it's not that they're deliberately lying, it's that they've been misled. It's that they don't know that it is how we do things in America. And it was largely for people who, there's no point, really, in arguing with the liars in power. Like, they know the truth, you know, they know the truth, and it's not like we need to reveal it to them.
So you don't think that any of these...
The second group that I wrote the book, the people who just don't know that it is how we do things in America, and it always has been.
Do you think any of these people who are responsible for spreading the lies about torture, do you think they're all aware that they're lying, or that there's, you know, that they're just repeating what they've been told?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about someone like Rumsfeld or like Bush, like, clearly they know that what they're saying is at least disingenuous, whether or not they have, you know, the full detail of what's happening. If you're talking about the media, who then repeats what they've said, what the politicians have said, basically, verbatim and as though it were fact, some of the better reporters will know that they're sort of continuing perpetuating the lie. The more naive reporters will, largely just think of their job as being, to repeat what people with power have said,
right,
and not really examine it one way or the other. It depends on where it falls in that. I suspect that there are, probably some, spokesmen for the Pentagon somewhere who genuinely believe that, like, they're doing everything that they can to prevent things like this from happening, and, really earnestly deliver the company line with every faith in the world that it's true. I'm sure there are probably people like that in those positions. But for the most part, the people who shape those lies know what they're lying about.
Tell me about some of the differences between the torture that we use abroad and the torture we use at home. I mean, even within this discussion, you tend to hear a lot of, okay, well, maybe we're torturing terrorists to get information from them, but as a culture, we don't torture people, and, America is very safe from that happening. But you go into quite a lot of detail in your book about the sort of torture that takes place in the American prison system, for example.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different or the same from the torture that Americans apply to foreigners?
That's a good question. The similarities are pretty clear. It's not just that what happened at Abu Ghraib, looks like some things that happen in American prisons. There are also institutional ties. Like, for example, Charles Grainer and Chip Frederick, who were the two highest-ranking soldiers tried for the Abu Ghraib scandal, were both prison guards in their, in their day jobs, stateside.
Right.
Similarly, the military police company that first went to Afghanistan and then later on ended up in Abu Ghraib was trained in pain compliance techniques by prison guards from the United States.
So they're acting out torture techniques that they would have learned at home, in other words.
Right, exactly. Like, techniques that were developed for controlling prisoners in U.S. prisons and then were very deliberately, exported into the combat theater. Similarly, to sort of take a different kind of case, some of the most brutal abuses that were used against prisoners in Guantanamo Bay were perpetrated by this squad called the Internal Reaction Force, or as the inmates call it, the Extreme Reaction Force, which is really sort of a goon squad that goes in to break up fights or remove prisoners from their cells when it's time for a search or that sort of thing. And the Internal Reaction Force was modeled on similar units in domestic prisons,
mm-hmm.
which in turn were modeled on SWAT teams from U.S. police forces, which, if you go back and look at the origin of the SWAT team, was modeled on special forces units from the U.S. military. So there we really have just the whole cycle from military to police to domestic prison to military prison. So the similarities are very real. As for the differences, the probably the main difference at present is that the soldiers overseas who are engaging in these sorts of abuses are largely doing it with some sense that that the rules will protect them, mm-hmm. that they are that they're acting under the authority of the president or the commander in chief, that they're within the rules of engagement.
Because they're at war, it's different than just your 9-to-5 job at the local prison.
Right. Given the, you know, the new context of the war on terror and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The guards working in U.S. prisons who engage in this same sort of abuses more recognize the that they're operating to some degree outside of the rules themselves, even though, you know, most of them rightly recognize that their supervisors just don't want to know about it and will turn a blind eye to it and will cover it up if they need to.
So the rules aren't being enforced, but at least they exist.
Right. And the so they, in general, I would say that is the bigger difference. Now, there are some there are particular techniques and particular kinds of cases where those aren't, you know, that sort of scheme doesn't exactly hold up. For example, I argue in the book that the use of long-term isolation in super maximum prisons or in secure housing units, at that point, the confinement itself becomes a kind of torture.
Right.
That the psychological and then the physical effects of being isolated 23 hours a day in a single room with basically no human contact at all.
The purpose of which is only to cause pain to the person being isolated.
And that itself constitutes a form of torture. And, you know, in that case, it's not just even that it's authorized. It's, you know, the institution is set up so that is the way that, you know, it's set up with exactly that treatment in mind. It's, you know, the super maximum security prison as an institution is designed for that kind of isolation. So that, you know, in that case, it's not even really the matter of what the individual officer's relationship to the rules is. The entire institution is arranged with this abuse in mind.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about, you describe in your book kind of the selective definition of the term rape. And rape and sexual abuse is common torture technique both here in the prison system as well as in Guantanamo Bay and certainly what we saw in Abu Ghraib. But generally we think of rape as we have this very traditional construct of the innocent white middle class girl being attacked by the dangerous inner city black man. And we don't extrapolate that to also include like the rape of Abner Louima.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about what goes into that.
Well, the argument I make is, the claim I put forward is even a little bit stronger than as you just portrayed it. It's not just that rape is common in these kinds of situations. It's that rape and sexualized abuse is central to the way torture gets used in our current society.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not just to say that because we have rape, therefore we have, you know, torture in prison and all that other stuff. But the way the torture is modeled on the pattern of sexual abuse. And in order to really make sense of that claim, it's important that we put aside the sort of stereotyped notion of what really constitutes rape, that you explained pretty well, that it involves, you know, a good girl being attacked by a stranger, which, you know, our culture being what it is, usually translates into in the stereotyped sort of fairy tale, usually translates into, you know, a privileged, innocent, young white woman being attacked by, you know, a black man.
Right, and any variations from that theme end up getting different names, like abuse or,
right,
or attack or something like that. The word rape seems to disappear when you step outside of that construct.
And it's, and in order to, right, and in order to make sense of sort of, well, partly just in the interest of, you know, recognizing the humanity of everyone involved, and and also in order to make sense of the prevalence of sexual abuse in our society, it's important that we not rely on that stereotype narrative,
mm-hmm,
and instead think about the, you know, the actual nature of the violation and the harm that it does to the dignity of the victim.
Right. So would you say that? So then, what you're saying is that sexual abuse and rape are a part of the systematic punishment of the prison system, and not like when you hear about, you see it on TV, someone going to prison, this idea that they might get raped in prison. You know, the idea is that's because prison is a dangerous place. But you would argue that the prison system itself is sort of designed to promote sex as a tool of punishment.
Not just as a tool of punishment, but as a way of controlling the inmate population, as a way of stratifying the prison society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a sociologists who study prison have done a pretty good job of talking about this, that there's a hierarchy among the prisoners which largely translates into the role that they occupy,
mm-hmm,
within a system of sexualized violence. And so, you know, you have the punks at the very bottom, and you have, you know, the real men at the top, and there's like, you know, some people put it in terms of pitchers and catchers and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's a, you know, somewhere in the middle there are the guys who pair up in protective sexual pairings, and the you know, there's a very complex social hierarchy, which in important ways resembles the sexual hierarchy of the larger society, with the telling difference that it's all men, or in the case of, you know, this is less important to women's prisons, because in women's prisons, for the most part, rape occurs between the guards and the inmates, and
right,
not between the inmates themselves. In men's prisons, it's mostly the inmates themselves.
Right.
Although the policies of the prison administration and the behavior of the guards does a great deal to shape how that hierarchy works, and, you know, recognizes legitimate certain kinds of sexual claims that the inmates make on each other. So it's really a central aspect to prison culture, and it's an aspect that the authorities in charge of the institution are more than willing to exploit,
mm-hmm,
in order to make the prison manageable.
Now, the byline to your book is Torture and the Logic of Domination. So I guess my question is, what is the logic of domination? I get this extinct impression from the Bush administration that they are, much like they were looking for ways to go to war in the first place,
mm-hmm,
lately they've been looking for ways to be allowed to do torture, either by calling it different names or coming up with excuses of why it's necessary. What is their incentive? Why do they want so badly to torture people? Like, is it a matter of are they conducting, you know, human social experiments in Guantanamo? Is there some sort of scientific benefit? Like, I have no idea. That's why I'm asking.
Well, to put it in the most simple terms, torture is an excellent tool of coercion. And states are in the business of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, knowing that this tool exists, the state wanting to exercise a monopoly of force is always going to be tempted to reach for it.
Mm-hmm.
In our current situation, we don't just have the situation of a state trying to control its own territory and, you know, using coercion in that sense. We also have the states trying to exercise this imperial sort of extraterritorial global control, where the U.S. government is trying to position itself in a role of unrivaled dominance over the entire Earth. And so there's so given that political agenda, and given the amount of trouble that it's having, you know, advancing that agenda, the use of torture is sort of a natural means for the ends that they're pursuing. And in fact, there's sort of an affinity between the ideology that justifies the United States being, you know, the global ruler, the global hegemon, and the ideology that legitimizes the state or the individual authorities' use of pain and humiliation to really to destroy the will of anyone who might oppose them.
Mm-hmm.
So really, that's what I mean by the logic of domination.
So they're trying to get the best of both worlds. Then on one side, they want the outside world to fear and respect with shock and awe through our use of brute force, and then on the other side of that coin, they want to be able to do it in such a way that that people still think of the United States as a positive force, doing good, extracting information from the bad guys, that kind of thing.
Right. I mean, there are really sort of two audiences.
Right.
There's the audience that the U.S. simply wants to intimidate and terrorize. And there's the audience that the U.S. is relying on for support and wants to view our government as, you know, legitimate and benevolent and worthy of backing. And so this causes problems, and this creates paradoxes where, you know, that means that on the one hand, the government needs to behave in some sort of openly thuggish ways,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, it needs to do its best for, you know, especially the audience of the first world to be presented with this sort of story of, you know, the U.S. being the standard bearer of human rights.
Right.
And the fact that both of those public images that it needs to put forward at the same time frequently conflict, leads to many of the absurdities that we've seen in the last few years.
Now, what about your audience? What about the audience, people who are going to read your book, American Methods? What do you want them to come away with, and what do you want them to do after they've read your book?
Well, I guess my audience is my main audience is an American audience. My main audience are people who live within the United States and who are concerned about, you know, what our government is doing, but you know, don't have haven't been given all of the resources to really examine it and make sense of it. Because, you know, interestingly, as much information about this as is available, you really do have to engage in sort of a research project to get even a broad idea of mm-hmm. what's going on and how, you know, events in Guantanamo Bay relate to events in Abu Ghraib, or how those relate to, you know, something that happens in Corcoran State Prison in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to give them, you know, the sort of big picture of how this stuff relates to each other. My hope is that it will really demonstrate the difference between the values that I think most of the people in the country have, and what they want their position in the world to be, and what in fact the government is doing in their name, and what it is using the sort of slogans of those values to justify. As for, you know, what they do for it, what they do with that, I talk about that a bit in the conclusion, and I lay out sort of two approaches. First, I say that it's absolutely necessary that we do, you know, whatever we can to bolster the existing international human rights regime, right? To bring the Geneva Conventions back into relevance, to support the work of human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and to you know, support things like the prosecution of war criminals, especially our own war criminals.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, none of that is going to be enough if what we really want is to eliminate torture altogether, not merely forbid it, or not merely punish token cases when, you know, the scandals become bad enough.
But if actually really remove it as a policy, as a cultural flaw.
If we really want to get rid of it altogether, we need to dismantle the institutions that are responsible for using it, and more basic than that, we need to address the system of social inequality that animates those institutions. So we need to push for more equality, basically in every aspect of society, between men and women, between the races, and, you know, between economic classes. So that's a pretty tall order.
Do you believe that most Americans want what you're describing, and that if they just had the right information around them, then they would organize and push for what you're describing, an end to torture? Just a personal belief, and not
right.
necessarily something you address in your book.
Let's see. That's a more complicated question than it may seem. Okay. There have been a series of recent surveys, as you may expect, mm-hmm. on how Americans feel about torture. And I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I do remember the general direction of it, which is that if you ask, would you support torture if it would help prevent a terrorist attack?
Mm-hmm.
A significant portion of the population say that they would. But if you start asking about specific techniques and whether they would endorse using those techniques under those conditions, the numbers immediately drop way, way down.
Because what people think of in terms of torture in their mind is, from what they've seen in movies, usually just, you know, beatings and things like that.
I think that's part of it. I also think that they're thinking, I don't even think they have anything that concrete in mind. I think they just have sort of this abstract notion. And once they start thinking about it in specific real terms, the support immediately diminishes.
Right.
And I suspect that this means that the word torture doesn't have the sort of moral weight that it should in our culture at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that there are real limits to what Americans will endorse, and that once you start talking about, what would you endorse, holding a man underwater almost to the point of drowning, like, all of a sudden, not very many people are in favor.
Even if it means preventing some abstract terrorist attack or something
right.
like that. Yeah.
And so I think that at present, because of the abstract terms in which it's put, for reasons of being able to generalize and for being able to talk about like things as a group, the support is artificially inflated for using these sorts of harsh techniques, and I think part of what the Abu Ghraib scandal shows us is that the more real we can make these techniques to the public, the less support there is going to be for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that translates into a willingness to totally rearrange our society so that social inequality and differences in power don't manifest in these ways, I mean, that's a separate question. And, clearly there's not a, there's not a large revolutionary sentiment among the American public right now. I don't think that, any mere accumulation of facts is going to change that,
mm-hmm.
but I do think it's possible that that given the sense that change is possible, that support for it will grow.
Let me ask you one more thing before I let you go. I appreciate you taking the time to spend with us at Kill Radio. In the research for this book, when you sat down to write this book, you went in with a hypothesis that that there is widespread use of torture by the United States outside its borders as well as inside. Were there any things that came up in your research that surprised you, that either went against your hypothesis or made things seem much worse than you anticipated going into it?
There were some things that there were some things that came out in the press while I was writing the book,
mm-hmm.
that surprised me.
Could you give an example?
For example, when I was about two-thirds of the way through the research, it was revealed that the U.S. was running secret detention facilities in Eastern Europe.
Right.
That surprised me. I wouldn't particularly be surprised. I wasn't surprised that the CIA had secret presence in Afghanistan. That was not particularly startling because we were occupying Afghanistan and we were fighting a war there. But the idea that there were extra legal and top secret prisons in Poland was a little bit startling. Similarly, the cooperation of other governments with U.S. efforts to, in some cases, illegally kidnap their citizens and ship them to third countries where they would be tortured.
Mm-hmm.
That I found pretty chilling. It's kind of interesting the way that the way that this breaks down is kind of unpredictable. Like in Sweden, for example, they apparently had a cabinet meeting about whether or not to turn over to refugees who had been granted asylum in Sweden who the U.S. wanted. And the cabinet voted in favor of doing so, and doing so secretly. And so, you know, one day these two guys were going about their business, and the next day they had totally vanished. Mm. And then they showed up in, I think, Egyptian prison, you know, a year later. Whereas we don't exactly know how the decision was made in Italy, but we do know that that Italian prosecutors have indicted about two dozen CIA agents as a result. Not really in keeping with the sort of stereotyped views of Sweden and Italy.
Right.
So some of that surprised me.
These countries are aware then that the United States, and when it's not in the business of torturing people itself, is sending people to countries where they're likely to be tortured, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of global opposition to this.
Well, it's not as though there's no global opposition to it. It's just that the opposition is not, it's not among the governments.
Right, right.
Civil society, on the whole, is opposed to, extraordinary rendition is the term of art, but pretty much everywhere, right? Like, very few sort of authentic social groups, like, actually favor the idea that our government is going to pluck citizens up off the street in their country and drop them in a dungeon somewhere.
Right.
But there's no... The opposition from states has been, for the most part, very muted and really somewhat unpredictable. I mean, the Italian case isn't just noteworthy because it's Italy. It's also noteworthy because it's pretty much the only place that the authorities have gone so far as to issue indictments.
Mm.
And hopefully that will change. Hopefully we'll see a lot more of that.
Your book is available through South End Press, which is well known for distributing great progressive political books. Is that where people should go to buy this book, southendpress.org?
That's probably the easiest general recommendation, yeah.
And do you have any other works that you want to recommend, either your own or something that you're reading currently?
My first book is specifically about the police in the United States, and it's called Our Enemies in Blue.
Mm-hmm.
It was published by Soft Skull Press, and there's going to be a second edition of that coming out next year from South End.
Excellent. Well, Christian, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and informing us of your quite powerful book, American Methods, Torture, and the Logic of Domination. And I look forward to hearing from you again.
Oh, thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Christian.
Goodbye.
Take care.
That was Christian Williams being interviewed here at killradio.org for his book, American Methods, Torture, and the Logic of Domination. You can get this book by going to southendpress.org, and while you're there, several other books you might be interested in checking out as well. It's good to see that people are writing this stuff. So thanks for tuning in to killradio.org, and you'll be able to download this interview later, both from killradio.org and from radioforall.net. That is all.